Our guest today has an unusual professional journey, from nurse to English professor to accepted, med, and a grad school admissions consultant. She's going to share her story, as well as her best advice on telling your story in today's episode.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 368th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thank you for tuning in. If you like this podcast, you're going to love the webinar we are having this evening called How to Write a Winning Med School Course Statement, to be presented by Accepted's Lolita Woodhill. Lolita, who has been in pre-health advising for decades, does a great job of providing actionable, practical advice on how to write an outstanding med school personal statement. The webinar is tonight at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. So don't miss it. You can reserve your seat for the live webinar tonight or download the recording if you are listening to this after the event took place, both at accepted.com/368webinar. Our guest today, Dr. Mary Mahoney, is Associate Professor of English at Elmira College and the recent winner of the Barnhill Essay Contest at that college. She focuses much of her work on medical narrative and teaches a course in medical humanities and will soon be teaching a course in narrative medicine. These courses, in Dr. Mahoney's words, help students understand and articulate why they want the medical career or healthcare career that they have been pursuing. In addition, Dr. Mahoney serves on the Elmira College Committee that reviews personal statements and provides feedback on mock interviews for Elmira students. Who can better help you tell your story in your personal statement? Dr. Mahoney, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you.
Glad you can join me. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? You have a very interesting background to focus so much of your teaching and work on medical humanities and narrative.
The story that I tell that kind of brings home a little bit of who I am and how I was raised is that I'm the youngest of five children in a pretty typical Irish family. And when I came home from high school one day and told my mom that I wanted to be a poet, she said, "That's terrific, but not until after you go to nursing school." And so that's what I did. I had a bunch of friends who were going into nursing school and I had no other clear direction. I came from a family of math people, auditors, accountants, all math people. And while I liked math, I really had no interest in doing anything like that. So nursing sounded good to me. I was kind of an empathetic kind of teenager. And so I went ahead and did that. But I was a nurse by the time I was 19 and started working as a nurse when I was 19, but just continued going to school full time over and over and over and over and over again, all the way through to the PhD. I didn't know that there would be a way to bridge the two, but I started writing about being a nurse when I was in my master's program at Sarah Lawrence College and received a whole lot of encouragement to continue writing that way because there was so little representation of nurses' point of view in essays and stories and articles and things like that. And people really, I thought that it kind of felt fresh in the sense that it wasn't writing that was a writer writing about being a writer. It was a writer writing about being a nurse. And that's where that began. And then I found a conference at Duke University, which was a conference on poetry and medicine. And it was all about the medical humanities. And that was how I found out about it and learned about it, in addition to seeking out journals where my writing would be suitable. If I can, I'll just segue into what the medical humanities is.
Yeah, that was my next question. What are the medical humanities?
Yeah.
Let's start with that.
Yeah, so basically, the medical humanities is an interdisciplinary focus on studying what living is, what life is, what it means to be a human, what it means to be a person, what it means to live in a body that gets sick, what it means to be mortal, what that means in relation to the people that we have relationships with, our cultures, our communities, and also how all of that informs who we are as individuals, which brings up really abstract aspects to who we are that frequently can be not seen in the communication between health professionals and patients. And so it's really trying to bring the fuller, more comprehensive aspect of being human into the space of medicine and vice versa, so that this way there's a much more reciprocal relationship between a practitioner and a patient.
Okay. When you started the definition, it was very broad.
Right.
And my follow-up question would have been, what's the difference between medical humanities and humanities?
Because ultimately, then, the focus has something to do with bodies that fail. You know, that at some point...
That's a distinction.
Yeah, that's the distinction. And also, I think the medical humanities is really for anyone who might be interested in it, but I think the idea of it as a curriculum is that it fosters empathy and teaches how to recognize empathetic feelings or empathetic moments as meaningful for people who are headed for the health sciences as a profession. So there is some sense of impacting one's learning that is specifically for people who are going into healthcare careers, nurses, doctors, PAs, on and on.
Right. And what is narrative medicine? That's not synonymous, right?
It's a close cousin.
Okay.
Narrative medicine. Rita Sharon over at Columbia University practices narrative medicine and has a narrative medicine, I believe it's a certificate program. She's a physician. And when she was on sabbatical, she then entered the graduate program in literature at Columbia University to see what she could do with it as a physician. And she believed deeply that this whole idea of narrative is something that would benefit physicians in their practice and healthcare practitioners in their practice, because communicating with patients, listening to not only what they're saying, but how they're saying it, reading about patient experiences in order to recognize situations where someone's aloneness is making their suffering worse. And so how do you use narrative to foster a bond between a patient and a healthcare practitioner in order to minimize the sense of aloneness so that you sort of stand in illness? I think that's Rita Sharon's phrase, to sort of stand tall in illness together. And so that will then possibly help some healing, not necessarily curing, if the distinction is clear. When people are not isolated and they have community, their suffering seems to be a little less. Their coping seems to be a lot better. And to think about the professional relationship of a healthcare practitioner as someone who's part of that patient's community, you know, or someone who is newly entering that patient's community, to be sort of standing in it with them as opposed to feeling disconnected.
My daughter was telling me that somebody she knows fairly well was hospitalized for corona recently. And he was in the hospital, I think, for over 2 weeks in the ICU for part of the time. He was not intubated, but he was very sick. And he wasn't that old. I think he's a man in his 40s. And he said that his wife took him to the hospital and she basically dropped him off. Nobody could see him. The only people that saw him, he said, were the nurses. And all he could see of them was their eyes.
Yeah.
And he said it was a very lonely experience.
Right.
You know, and he said they were very kind. That we didn't have any gripe against the quality of care, but the experience itself, no family to visit at certain points, and probably 2 weeks to really talk on the phone or do a Zoom call or whatever. So he got better when he did. Kids couldn't visit. Parents couldn't visit. Wife couldn't visit. Completely, completely alone.
Yeah.
And all he could see of the caretakers, the nurses, the doctors, etc.
Yeah. I think that isolation is trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And given in this current situation, I think more people can feel and see how devastating that is when and it's happening en masse. It's happening to so many people and consequently so many families, right? Because illness never just affects one person, but it affects the whole family.
Absolutely.
You know, the whole family gets sick, so to speak. I'm not sure that we necessarily address that kind of, it's almost like an existential crisis, you know, where you are so alone for so long at in a time of need.
Absolutely.
And you're so disconnected. And I think that it's very traumatic. I'm sure that there will be a lot of PTSD for survivors of corona. You know?
Right.
I mean, even people who never went to the hospital who were felt that they were very, very sick and in bed for like a week or a week and a half.
Struggling to breathe.
Report back that it was just horrendous.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've heard. Yeah. Now this is getting depressing. Let's turn to the medical application. Okay. Do you have any suggestions as to what applicants should do before they start writing personal statements? What should they do before they start?
I'm a real believer in making sure you're writing something that you care about, you know, that you're saying something that you really mean. And so sometimes I think that takes, especially from my experience, especially for science students, sometimes the leaping over into the space of feeling and to say something sort of exposed, where you're revealing something about your inner self. And you're putting it down on the page, I think that it makes people feel vulnerable. I think it's difficult to do because it's a little bit counterintuitive to the way the scientists think. You know, it's not necessarily rational, but it is fluid, right? So I'm a big believer in pre-writing. My advice is always start with a prompt, but don't feel compelled to stick with the prompt, but follow yourself intuitively. And the only rule in the pre-writing is to set a clock, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and to never stop typing or never stop. If you write longhand, never stop writing. Even if you digress, let yourself digress because, you know, on some intuitive level, you're going somewhere and you don't have pressure on yourself to say something astute or profound right out of the gate. And then you go for a walk, you come back, you do it again with a different prompt or to explore something from the past, an experience that you really feel like you need to unpack a little bit in order to be able to tell it right. That is in some way a formative moment in your upbringing with that suddenly you now understand that experience has a lot to do with why I want to be a doctor and really will be a doctor in my future, that it's destined for me. And so, and to go back and explore those experiences in writing, the biggest writer's block is worry.
Worry about what?
Worrying about what to write. And so to just start writing where it doesn't matter, nobody has to see it. Nobody has to review it. And to just do it according to the clock, I think really gets things flowing. And then the other prompts too, sometimes I encourage people to read a little bit, to go to a book and read for a little while, because if you're caught in a book where the book is kind of taking you somewhere, you're going to step away from that book, still kind of writing in your head, and that's a good way to sit down and just start writing. And then sometimes music, to play music that puts you in a relaxed state and to play it as you like and to write while you're doing it.
Yeah, I like the last one. I sometimes do the last one.
Music.
Right? Yeah. Now, we sometimes talk about applicants' voice, right, and their writing, or maintaining their voice, finding their voice. Obviously, we don't want them writing an essay, or they shouldn't write an essay like they talk on social media. That would not be right. But how can they write in a mature way, professional way, and still maintain their voice and sound like them and tell their story?
Yeah, finding voice is kind of tricky. I think it takes a little while for that to happen for most people. I think initially apprehensive writers will write in a way where their writing feels a little bit stilted or a little stiff. Sometimes we'll start writing and it'll sound way too academic, or it sounds way too much like you're sort of building a pedigree. Storytelling seems to me to be the way to go. So how I explain that sometimes is this, is that the word essay actually means to weigh something. And so you choose an experience to explore, but you're not arguing. You're not trying to correct anything. You're not trying to incriminate anyone. You're not trying to necessarily then sort of walk out into a major epiphany. You're just trying to weigh it, to look at it for a little while and stay with it. And once you begin that, I think voices start to soften and they start to relax into their own kind of language. And then we go back to the revision process over and over and over again until you can kind of stand with every word that you use. That's one way. And the other way is to take something you've written and read it out loud. If you're stumbling through what you've written, you're not really finding your voice, because we have rhythms and we have paces and we have patterns to our voice on the page. And it might correspond a little bit with our conversational voice, but it's not the same thing as talking.
Great. Yeah. I actually recommend reading out loud as a great way to proof.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I still do that.
So do I. Yeah. So do I. Now, I've sometimes seen you write clients, quote, you lost the narrative here. You lost the narrative here about somewhere in a personal statement that you've reviewed. What does that mean as far as you're concerned? How can you find it again? You know, it's lost and found. Right? So. Yeah.
Narrative, in the study of narratology, right? There's a whole
field of narratology. I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a belief, a conceit that narrative is a sense-making mechanism, and that as we live our lives, we're at a very, very young age, culturally, we are sort of shown how to turn our experiences into stories. So that if we wanted to communicate experiences from our lives, we really would just be following a clock, right? That we would just be going through sequences in time, but we wouldn't necessarily be creating anything that had any kind of curve that was an emotional curve that kind of gave the story some currency. And so we use narrative to make sense of things. So we either make sense of our experiences toward universal narratives, the way we expect the experiences are supposed to go, or we experience something that shatters the universal narrative, and then we have to write something up in order to explain the truth of something that didn't go according to the universal narrative. And so we use narrative as a sense-making mechanism, you know, even like in therapy or in talking something through until we can kind of figure it out. It takes an experience that's outside language and it moves it into the space of narrative form until we can author it to a truth. That's what narrative does. So when someone loses their narrative, is that they're losing, that they've lost the continuity of making sense in the thread of what they've been writing. They jump tracks, or they've moved over into saying something that maybe they feel they're supposed to say instead of what feels like what they should be saying according to their own truth that they've set up on the page. So suddenly it dissolves or it hops off path or what.
But is it kind of like when you're talking and let's say you're telling a story, okay, as we do very naturally in everyday conversations constantly, you know, telling a story and then we lose our train of thought and go into another direction. So what happened to that original story?
I
just flash back. One time my daughter was living in another city. At the time, she actually had three kids, but the two younger ones were two little girls. One was about a year and a half, so she was just learning how to talk. And the other one was probably three and a half or four. And one day I was talking with my daughter, and the little one was sitting in my lap. And, you know, she could put together two or three word sentences at that point, however old she was, maybe she was two. And all of a sudden she says something like, Gaka Kai, Gaka Kai. Gaka was the nickname for her big sister. And Kai, when she was crying, I was like, I didn't understand what she was saying. So my daughter all of a sudden just burst out laughing. And I'm like, what is going on? Well, what happened was is that the little one took something good and hard and threw it and it connected with the older one. She threw something at her sister's head and threw it, period. Probably didn't want to hit it in the head. And it hit her in the head. That whole thing of telling a story, she didn't get confused, started on another tangent at that point. She was lucky enough to get the two words out. The bit of telling stories and relating experiences, it goes down that young.
Oh, absolutely. And without question.
And it's universal.
And I think that the recognition that there's a story here that needs to be told even happens before we begin to speak or write it. You know, that there's a recognition that something needs to be represented in language here, that something that I just experienced. I attended a conference once where we were talking about another uplifting subject. It was an interdisciplinary conference in Vienna, Austria, actually. And it was a wonderful conference. And it was all about death and dying. Sorry. Here we go again. But Nonetheless, there was a gentleman there who was a professor at the University of Tel Aviv, and he had just completed some work, some studies on grief. And he had lost a son as a soldier. The son was a soldier, and he died in service. And they belonged to a parent group for parents who had lost children in the war. And so the parents were processing grief, and the counselors or the therapists who were working with them told them that this is what you could expect, that this will get easier in time, and that you'll start to forget. And the parents became very, very upset, and they said, no, we're never going to forget. You know, we might be able to cope a little bit better, but that does not mean that we've forgotten anything. And so they stuck it out and stayed with, and the therapist also had like a time frame for appropriate grief. And the parents said, that's not right. This is not, that's absolutely not true. And so they continued in these groups, coming back in and telling their stories, and the stories would get written down or taped. And they saw that the emotional currency of the stories that they told didn't change in time, that they didn't soften and change in time. Maybe the extent to which they told the story maybe the story got shorter, but the emotional currency of it didn't change. And their efficiency in telling their truth of that same story over and over again got more confident. You know, their sense of their authority and being the author of telling the story became something that they took command of, so that then they ended up changing the data and the research for grief counseling. And it had to do with...
Really?
Yeah, with knowing their narrative and knowing and sticking with it and telling their story over and over and over until they would be accepted. And they changed it. It was fascinating, absolutely fascinating. But that's narrative, right? And
right.
So many things. And now that was like a reversal. It went back and changed the data, which...
That's fascinating.
So many people hang on to first, more so than story.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit off topic, but I'm gonna share a story now. We actually lost our youngest son, not in battle, to illness. So I was, years later, I heard about a neighbor who had lost a child, not a neighbor I knew. And my husband and son actually ended up paying condolence calls. And I said, Mom, they came home and said, you got to go over there. So I went over and I met the woman, the mother, the bereaved mother, 2.5-year-old child who passed away in a pool accident. And we met occasionally over the years. And then one day I was talking with a professional colleague who's very interested, and she's not a psychologist by profession, but she was talking, it actually was an accepted consultant who was working with a client, and the client she felt had not processed grief. And she told me that with grief, you go through these 10 stages, and then you're okay, you're done. She didn't put it that baldly. That was basically the message.
Right.
And I was thinking to myself, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Psychologists don't know what they're talking about. You don't. And that evening, as it happens, I went to a memorial service. And as I was walking out, I ran into this mother who'd lost her daughter at that point. It was several years earlier. And we were walking out, and obviously it was a memorial service. It was a sad occasion. And I told her, and she's a psychologist by profession, and I told her about this conversation with my colleague, whom I like and have the highest opinion. And I said, what do you think of that? And she just says, that's how it works.
Yeah. So these stages, right, these flow charts that we hang on to show us the process of sort of the movement of our emotional lives toward a space of healing end up not being how it goes, where the truth really relies upon the narrative as opposed to the steps. You know,
right.
The nuances inside narrative would change. Like, you and I could write similar stories with a fact. I had one of my sisters passed away when I was 34 and she was 39 of a rapid radical cancer. And, she had two teenage children.
Oh, and gosh.
It was devastating. Actually, her oldest daughter just had a baby yesterday. So,
congratulations.
And they're good. They're nice.
Yeah.
Big, healthy kid. So that would make my sister very, very happy. But so we could write these stories of, you know, these intimate losses,
right,
that go against the universal narrative. They're not supposed to happen that way. Right.
Right.
Not
right.
The way things are supposed to happen. But the way you would write yours and the way that I would write mine would have inferences. And there's a poet, Lee Young Lee, who says a story and a poem that they have three bodies. They have the body of what's said, the body of what's inferred, and the body of what's not said. And so inside narrative, it's never just the words that you choose, but it's the mood and the tone and the inference and all of those things that come out with when we develop a relationship with language that corresponds with the sound of our voice and not necessarily our spoken voice. And so all of those other textures are what make us individuals, and they come through in the body of a narrative.
And the voice.
And the voice. So as opposed right. to the stages of your grief. You know, it's
right. It's as opposed to a checklist, or a checklist, a flow chart, or whatever, you know, forget it.
Story of your grief, right.
Right.
Right. Anyway.
Well, you and I could continue on this vein, I think, for a long time, but I want to try and bring this back to right. applying to medical school and grad school, okay?
Well, maybe we just help people understand grief a little bit better.
Well, that might be beyond the scope of this podcast. let's bring it very practically back to admissions, okay? How should the statement of purpose for graduate school differ from the medical school personal statement?
The thing that I think is kind of a very distinct way to separate the two is that the statement of purpose looks forward and the personal statement looks backwards. We look back at our experience or an experience or several experiences that link, that somehow bring us to the present of who we are so that you understand me better. Whereas the statement of purpose looks forward. How can I show you that I'm ready and I'm right. suitable for what this program is and the type of people that you educate. And right. that's how I kind of keep them. The one looking forward, one looking back is a really easy way for me to keep them.
Yeah, and I think that's spot on. That's yeah. spot on. What do you believe that, I mean, you've worked with a lot of students and applicants, you've obviously reviewed hundreds of essays, more, thousands. What do applicants frequently just not understand about writing the medical school personal statement that they really should grasp before they start applying?
Yeah, you don't want to write about your accolades.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's not about documenting your achievements. It's about giving a snapshot of you. And yes, you know, all these achievements are beautiful and wonderful and difficult to achieve. You know, I'm not denying their significance, but this is a moment that's about you, not about the awards and honors and achievements and GPAs and all of that kind of stuff. I think it's interesting. I don't know if you saw today that
UC
and
California
Cornell
yeah.
are dropping ACTs and SATs.
Yeah, no, that actually, I think that came out yesterday. Today. Yeah. No, I did know about that. Yeah.
I'm interested to see what that does to the application process. I mean, it has to make the writing move to the head of the line.
I'll make it much more subjective, to be sure.
Yeah.
I agree with you. What are your tips for editing a personal statement or other essays that comprise the medical school application process or the graduate school application process?
I think there's frequently a little bit of a reality check that when an applicant thinks, and I'm generalizing, and it's not
always, of course.
It's not always true, but when an applicant thinks he or she is done with the revision
yeah.
process,
yeah.
I can see maybe four more revisions ahead. And, you know, so that their idea of a final draft is short. And they need to keep pushing and pushing the narrative forward. And also the editing, you know, getting rid of excess words, making sure a paragraph really works as a paragraph, basic writing skills. You know, I like to tell my students that even when we're writing something that is purposeful for our lives. Like these statements, like they're not writing them for fun. They're writing them for an application.
I mean, writing them for a grade.
But there's still this idea of composing them, right? And to think about it a little bit more like you would think about the word compose a little bit more like you would think about it in art or music, that you have a blank page and there's an opportunity here to compose, and that in the essay itself is a composition.
You've also been very much involved in mock interviews at the college. What's your advice for interview prep?
I know that this was a little bit controversial in the open forum that we did on the coronavirus about 6 weeks ago or so, but I still say know your stories. You know, I'm not saying rehearse your stories and I'm not saying memorize your stories, but I think to really spend time knowing, like, what's the worthwhile thing that you can say about yourself to share, or what would be the points of conversation that would add some integrity to the conversation that you're having with someone. I think when we talk to people, we've tried in different ways, in different circumstances, in different settings, to communicate with other people and share something about ourselves. And sometimes it fails and sometimes it succeeds. And when you know the ones that succeed, then we can refine them a little bit. So this way we carry them with us. And they're not lies. They're just stories that we have told before. But they do give good representation to who we are. But I also think that you have to think about it as an exchange with this other person who's talking to you, that it's not just one-sided. It's not an interrogation, but that it is an opportunity to demonstrate a conversation. So, you know, I'm all for having snippets and little things that you carry with you in your head that help to alleviate the anxiety that you might be having at the moment for speaking with a stranger during a pretty critical time. And so to have those things with you and to know the stories that are the stories that you can tell and to know how to tell them.
I think it's a great idea.
I don't mean that something as inauthentic as memorization. That's not.
No. I'm not talking about that either. What I sometimes recommend applicants do is, like, think of some things that they would want the medical school to know. That, you know, that's part of it. But also think about the school's values and mission. So if the school says we're looking for compassionate doctors, we're looking for doctors who are interested in rural medicine, living medicine, international medicine, whatever it is, be prepared with stories, narratives,
yes,
that will help show that you fit that mission, or you share that value, or you have the compassion and the listening skills, the communication skills that they're looking for.
Yes, yes. And that there's more to who you are than all of the hardcore schooling that you've been doing. And, I mean, it is all-consuming, and it is very daunting to be good at it. But I think that you kind of have to show that there are other sides to you too, you know, that it's not just all about the goal necessarily, but that you're a human with dreams and vision, and you want to walk through this life in a certain way. And here you are.
Sounds good. Any last words of advice for the personal statement, either, or the statement of purpose for that matter, for grad school?
Be true. Be true to yourself. Sometimes I hear students, sometimes I hear clients feeling as if they're trying to construct, to have something to say, and they're trying to read into a conversation with me when I'm talking to them about what maybe they should say, as opposed to understanding their own truth. And, you know, for any writing, to go in the direction of what you think you're supposed to say is always going to be a problem, but that you go in the direction of, you know, the truth, and you figure it out and you tease your way through it. It is interesting to see that there's still pressure on people to feel as if they what their real experience is somehow isn't worthy enough, so that they want to write what they think that they're supposed to write, as opposed to what they really know or have lived.
Right. Very, very good words of advice. Is there anything you wish I would have asked you about?
A quote that I love
Okay, go for it.
That actually came from some material that I was gathering together to teach class. And it comes from an article about how the medical humanities became important in the education of a physician. Okay. And that quote is that authentic engagement is transformative. And so I love that, because the idea that if a practitioner is having authentic engagement with a patient and the patient is having authentic engagement with the practitioner, that something suddenly becomes very transformative between them. And I think that that is really the goal of the, what would be the right word, the therapeutic relationship. And I think that that's really beautiful, and I believe it. So authentic engagement is transformative. How beautiful. Okay.
That is beautiful. Yeah. And of course, that there is an emotional part to healing also.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's, you know, that might also be part of that authentic engagement. Yeah. And it has a therapeutic component as well.
Absolutely.
That's a beautiful thought. And with that, Dr. Mahoney, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Listener, if you would like to learn more about Dr. Mahoney or benefit from her expertise in medical and grad school admissions, not to mention her outstanding ability to guide you in telling your story, we're going to include links to her bio in the show notes at accept.com/368, as well as a link to her contact page. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Mary Mahoney and me for the 368th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe. That way you won't miss any of our future shows, whether with admissions directors, writing experts, test score pros, alumni doing great things, or fantastic admissions consultants. You can find subscribe links in the show notes at, you guessed it, accepted.com/368. One last quick reminder, don't miss tonight's live webinar, How to Write a Winning Med School Personal Statement at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Save your seat at accepted.com/368webinar. Thanks again for coming. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.